Hi, this is Barry Liss at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science at Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Can we approach important decisions systematically and scientifically? In today's segment, we speak with Ron Howard, a professor at Stanford University and an informative voice in the creation of decision theory. He's also the co-founder of the Decision Education Foundation, a nonprofit that helps young people avoid the kind of decisions that can set them on the wrong path for years to come. Professor Howard's career is the subject of an interview in the INFORMS journal, Decision Analysis. Professor Howard, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you very much, Barry. Pleasure to be here.
In brief, what does a decision analysis do?
Well, what in decision analysis, you look at the many factors that can influence a decision. In particular, the metaphor I like to use, it's like a three-legged stool. To make a decision, there are three elements that you have to have. One is alternatives, different courses of action you can follow. The second is information, how those choosing those different alternatives may lead to different futures, and these will be futures over time and also with different probabilities of happening. And finally, the third leg is preferences, which is how much you like these different futures with their different probabilities and different times and different dimensions. So we call that the decision basis, the alternatives, the information, and the preferences. And that doesn't tell you what to do. For that, you need a logic that is not the logic we learned in school, if A then B, if B then C, deterministic logic, but rather a logic that works when you're making decisions under uncertainty. And it's consistent with deterministic logic when there is no uncertainty, but it applies to problems where, of the kind we usually face, the only interesting ones in decision-making, where we are uncertain. So this logic plus the decision basis tells you what to do. The most important element in making a decision is the frame you use for it, because the frame determines all the other elements of the decision basis. For example, if you're thinking about renting a place, for the next few years, then your alternatives would be different places you can rent. Your preferences would be about, for example, how long you might be able to get a lease for, will the rent be higher, and so forth. And your information would be exactly about those kinds of issues. If you, on the other hand, were going to buy a place, those you're looking at different alternatives for buying, then you would be concerned with things that wouldn't come up when you're renting, like what is the resale value of this property? Will I be able to sell it for different prices at different times? And your preferences be on those financial elements. And you would also know that you have much more freedom with any change that you might want to make in the property during that time. So the frame determines everything. And it's the one element of decision-making that it's kind of invisible to people. They usually take the frame that they have and proceed on that basis, which leads them to what we call the error of the third kind, which is getting the right answer to the wrong problem. So all these elements come together to give you what we call clarity of action, the best thing for you in this situation.
So you try very specifically to articulate these questions.
Yes, and matter of fact, we have what I call a precise decision language, because most of the conversation that we have about decision-making is made in terms that are not clear to all the parties. For example, in a company, if we're talking about will this product have technical success, well, different people in the room may have different notions of technical success. And it's not until we employ a test I call the clarity test to see whether they're all using the same distinction when they mean technical success. Because until you have that distinction clearly defined, there's no point in talking about the chance of technical success. In other words, until you know what you're talking about, there's no point in saying anything about it, like the chance that it will happen. So we clearly emphasize the distinction between what you're talking about and then what you're saying about it in terms of the chances that it will happen. And we put a lot of effort into being accurate in both of those, the clarity of the distinction and the probability assessments on it.
I gather you don't consult to government, and the reason I mention that is that in the interview you gave in decision analysis, you had some harsh things to say about government decision-making based on an experience you had way back in the Carter administration involving a nuclear reactor. What happened and what lessons did you learn about working or not working on government problems?
Well, we had several experiences that all came together at that time. One was that we worked on the Carter administration on this question of what should they do with the reprocessing plant that had already been built in South Carolina in Barnwell, which would have been enabled us to use reprocessing and actually use nuclear fuel once again. But when Carter came in, he said, no, this might encourage nuclear fuel getting into the wrong hands and decided to close it down. Well, Congress was not too happy about this, so they commissioned a study of the plant being closed down. And we did a piece of that study at the Decision Analysis Group of SRI. And we did a pretty good analysis, and we would make presentations. And one of the things that we said was, well, essentially whether you want to just completely dismantle it or put it into some kind of mothballs depends, and this is no surprise, on the probability that it might want to be used again in the future. It was a huge investment, and a very extensive investment had already been made. And then we were told, wait a second, you can't talk about the chance it's being used again because we have a presidential policy that we're not going to do this. And so we pointed out, yes, but, you know, presidents are in office for a few years, and we're talking about something that'll last 50 years. And they said, no, you can't do that. So we had to get rid of that whole section of the report. Well, this process continued. Now, this was a pretty big contract, you know, lucrative contract. But the end result was every time we made a presentation, pieces of it would be said, you can't say that, until finally not one comma remained of all, I think, very good work that we had done. And that was extremely dispiriting. I mean, at one point, we were discussing this with an official in the administration, and we pointed out, you know, Congress commissioned this study. That's why we're doing it. And he said, you know, we don't give a damn what Congress wants. That was literally his expression. And I said, okay, so much for doing work that will be useful in helping the country find a better way to do certain things that it has to make a decision about. But if this were the only case where I had this dispiriting result, it would be perhaps I could treat it as an exception. But what I found is every time I did study like this, I found that the results, there was nobody home in terms of really wanting to know the results.
Turning to another topic, you've given a public lecture that's on the Internet that posits the question, why don't we make good decisions? Can you give us an overview of your answer to that question?
Well, there are probably several answers that could be given, but one of the ones that I think is fairly broad in its implications is we can think of our brains as having at least two parts. Different people describe them in different ways, but one we might call the cool cognitive system. That's what we call the realm of reason in our prefrontal cortex. And the other is the more primitive brain, the part that on which the cortex was added. Now, we share that with animals and other things. And so whenever we have a decision to make, We are giving a signal, in my view, from both of these brains. One is what our higher thinking selves would say, and also what the one on which our design was based would say. And what affects this other system, which you might call the affective or emotional decision system, are things like sex and hunger, those things that would affect almost any living creature. And we see this when we have a plan, we're going to lose weight. This would be good for us to lose weight, I make that resolution. But then here comes this wonderful dessert on the menu. And that other system, which is tastes good, likes sweet, eat it now, don't wait for later, you know, the whole idea of that other brain is you don't wait for the future, you just do it now because somebody else may take it if you don't get it now. And so we're in a conflict all the time, and I think you can see that in, you know, the concern about obesity in America, that it, that this more ancient brain is having much more implications for our actions than the cooler one, which is what's really in our interest. We all face this. This is not something that we can be freed from. It's, you know, with respect to exercise or saving for the future versus spending now, you know, go now, pay later. All of those things are balances between these two influences that we have. And of course, what I do is really training and helping to buttress up the thinking part of the brain so that it will be better able to understand, first of all, what it ought to do, and secondly, why doing it may be difficult given some of the underlying anatomy that's pushing you toward another direction.
So you accept what we would say is I'm only human, but you add this training aspect to overcome some of the emotional sides of our decisions.
But, you know, it's also been demonstrated. But, you know, I consider that what we do relies heavily on the work of behavioral decision scientists who look at how people really do make decisions, because that shows often the shortcomings of what we call our intuition. Okay? So if you don't have a better way of looking at it, like decision analysis ideas, then you will do what intuition and gut feel and so forth indicate to you, and we know that that will often go astray. As a matter of fact, it goes astray not when we're looking what somebody else has done, but when they're looking at it and they say, what was I thinking? And that's the whole idea. It's not imposing on people some way that they don't want to think. It's when they look at what they did and say, that's the way I wanted to think. Why didn't I think that way? That's what we're trying to avoid.
We talked earlier about your research into life and death decisions and how you felt somewhat thwarted dealing with the government. When it comes to life and death decisions, most of us dread being put in that situation. I'm sure that providing a framework can be both a tremendous aid and, at emotional times, a great comfort. How do you advise people to approach these kinds of choices?
Well, you know, death is the one, somebody was said once that dying is the one subject that people are more uncomfortable talking about than sex. In other words, I don't know very many people who don't think they're going to die, but yet somehow it's kind of taboo. I even heard that one of my lawyer friends said that something like a third the people in this state die without having made a will. You know, with implications for lots of other people.
I think that's certainly true in American society.
Yeah, that's my belief. So anyway, you know, instead of ignoring it, I mean, the question is, how are you going to live your life in this, knowing you have uncertainty, knowing you have risks that you face of all kinds, but also that these things give you pleasure. In other words, picture someone doing rock climbing without any kind of safety net, right? Just using their hands and their feet, they might die. And they would say, yeah, but if someone was holding me with a rope, it would take an important element of the pleasure I get out of doing it, and knowing that in some sense I'm putting my life on the line. And that's fine. So all I'm suggesting is that you look at each of these things we might do from the ones that we might do for recreation to those that we do in everyday life, and just say, okay, what is this a good decision for us to be doing this kind of thing? And you know, I do this in terms of a measure that I define, a micromort, which is a 1 in a million chance of dying. That gives us the right unit to think about some of these things. So let's say someone says, I want to go skiing. You know, is that a good idea for me? Well, you know, we can look at the costs of skiing, the lift tickets, the equipment, all that kind of thing. We can look at the hassle cost, the traffic jam, what you'd be willing to pay to avoid that, and so on. And you can think about the benefits of it, those minutes of whistling down the hill, you know, enjoying the beautiful scenery, feeling your interaction with the snow and the mountain. So those pluses. And then you're also taking a chance of dying. Wall Street Journal had an article in a few years ago on how many micromorts, in my terminology, you get per day from one day of skiing in these places. And it wasn't zero. Okay, there was one of them that was about 10 micromorts a day. So for me, you know, I have a way of valuing micromorts, and everybody can. For me, you know, they tend to be more valuable when you have more money and less valuable the older you get. So let's say for me it's been running around $10 for a long time. So if somebody says to me, you know, you got 10 micromorts from skiing in this place for a day, then I say, okay, at $10 a piece, that's $100 cost from that death risk. And let's look at, you know, how much the lift tickets are, how much I'm going to enjoy it, and so on, and see whether it's a good decision. I once did this for a student in class. When I student, I mean, this was a man who was out working and came to a special class. And he said, well, I'm a skydiver, and, you know, should I be doing that? So he told us how much he valued those moments of falling through the air and the cost of the plane and the time of the equipment and all that kind of stuff and the micromorts you might get. We got all that figured out. And what at the end of the end result was that we said, look, it's okay for you to skydive. This is a net benefit to you when all these things are considered. However, you should never have started.
Ah.
What he said was the initial death rate is much higher, just as it is in motorcycling. So if it's okay to, once you've learned that, I was a motorcyclist for 50 years, and I know the first
50 years.
Deadly ones, right? So if you can get over that hump, it's a good deal for you, was for him, but he never would have started if he had known what he faced and the value he was putting on his life. So that gives you a kind of dramatic example of how you could use this. Doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing these things, but you got to see if this is a prudent risk for you.
I was intrigued to learn that among the courses you teach are one called The Ethical Analyst, and a second was called Designing a Free Society. What do you teach in these courses?
Well, the ethics course is they're actually very closely related. The ethics course is about designing a personal ethical code. I just wrote a book on that with my former student Quint Korber called Ethics for the Real World. And that, what we do in that course is look at essentially, if you're going to design your own personal ethical code, what would you have in it? And we tell them up front, look, don't make one that looks good, but you're not going to follow. It's only for you. So what actually are you going to do in these different elements and distinctions that we make about ethics? And some of them are, you know, harming people. That's one of the basic ethics. What are you going to do about harming people? What are you going to do about interfering their property? And the third one, which is what we spend the most time on, is issues of truth-telling. Because most of the students in the class are not much tempted to hurt people or steal. But telling the truth and being non-deceptive is more of a challenge. So a lot of it goes to that. Now, the relationship of this course to the other one is, the other course, the Designing Free Society, is about what part of your personal ethical code are you willing to impose on other people by force? Because the legal system is all about use of force against you or your property if you do or don't do different things. That's the only thing. It's not about, you know, nice to write your call your mother every week or something like that. It's about, you know, if you spit in the subway, $25 fine. That's what it's all about. So you have to think now, what part of my personal ethical code am I willing to impose on others? And that's a really big study, and that takes us a whole quarter. So the two courses are related.
We only have time for a few more questions, and I thought I would ask you to tell us about your Decision Education Foundation. What is
Surely.
It? What
well,
does it do?
I'd be happy to do that. Well, this is a foundation we started, about 7 years ago, this was pretty much founded by the people who started SDG and their colleagues, because they were all successful consultants. And they said, you know, it's great to be able to help companies make better decisions and so forth, but we know that everybody should be knowing this, and in particular we think the young people of America and we don't even know how young, might go back to kindergarten, but certainly high school, should be getting an opportunity to think this way that has been so useful to people in industry. So we started this foundation, and it's dedicated to giving the same decision skills that we give to our graduate students, perhaps, you know, in grad school much more mathematically and so forth. But in terms of basic principles, some of the things we've talked about here, like the three-legged stool story, that kind of description is very useful to students. So we've developed high school curricula. We've got special programs we've developed in both English and history to show how the regular teaching in those areas in high school, you know, teaching Macbeth, for example, in English, they can now, the teacher who's been through the training can say, okay, now what did Macbeth know at that time, and what choices did he really have? In other words, look at the decisions that were made. So they're still getting the whole story, but they're getting this notion of continually putting a decision, interpretation, framing, all those things we talked about in understanding that story.
And you mentioned Macbeth. I know that I've seen that you also deal with Shakespeare's To Be or Not to Be.
Absolutely. We do that.
The soliloquy from Hamlet. Right?
We do that in class, and we talk about that as a very basic demonstration of how you can take something like Hamlet's soliloquy and get a deeper understanding of it by looking at it from the principles of decision analysis.
How do you get a teenager to make a better decision about, say, getting into a fight or becoming pregnant?
Well, the one of the things we've noticed is that it's helpful to just think about having them stop for a moment. And I heard recently from, actually, I went to a talk by a fellow who's considered the Gandhi of Sri Lanka. And he mentioned a phrase that I think we're going to use more in the Decision Education Foundation, which was, respond, don't react. Okay, respond, don't react. In other words, when something happens, instead of going into automatic, maybe that's that other brain we talked about, say, you just take a little pause there and say, how shall I respond to this situation? Just think about road rage, for example. Instead of saying, look at that guy to me, I'm going to do the same to him, boy. You say, wait a second, why am I doing that? And just that pause is enough. So in that pause can come the kind of thinking that we were talking about earlier. What alternatives do I have? What preference? So forth. And wait a second, this doesn't make any sense to me. Why should I try to cut off this guy when I'm just making more danger for myself and other people? Maybe I should just smile and let it go. So that's the kind. And the same thing, you know, that if you wait until you're in the back seat of the car, to take your other example, it's kind of too late. That other brain is starting to getting a lot of influence on you. So the first thing you've got to think about, what situations do I want to be in? It's the same thing as why an alcoholic might not want to spend a lot of time in a bar if he's trying to give up drink. There's no point in putting yourself in temptation when you know you have this other part of your brain that's going to make you weak, and perhaps and the thinking part not have enough influence.
What kind of feedback are you getting from these young people?
Well, we get feedback at several levels. We get feedback from whole school systems who are saying, you know, it's not just a matter of teaching this stuff in our classes. It's a matter also of having the people who are dealing with the children, like the ones who are responsible for discipline and so forth, having those people also understand these principles of decision making. So we have this notion of the whole school kind of learning, not literally everybody in it, but it's not just something that goes on for the students. It's something that many of the teachers also want to build into their lives, and that go into every other area of things like discipline.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Ron Howard of Stanford University. Professor, thank you for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Science Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more information about Operations Research and their series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.